So yesterday you study the first and second noble truths. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering, and the second noble truth is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So the first noble truth is the effect. The second noble truth is the cause. And in Pali, the first noble truth is called what? Dukkha. Dukkha Riya Satya. So just dukkha. And then the second noble truth is called Sammudaya. S-A-M-U-D-A-Y-A. Samudaya means cause. So actually it is called Dukkha Samudaya, cause of suffering. And what is suffering? Everything in the world is suffering, right? In short, what are said to be suffering? The last sentence, in short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering, right? So in detail, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, and so on. And then the second noble truth. What is the second noble truth? It is the cause of dukkha. And what is the cause of dukkha? Craving, right. So in Pali it is called tanha. Okay. So tanha is the cause of suffering. But is tanha the only cause of suffering? No, there are other causes as well. But here, tanha is prominent. So it is said to be the cause of suffering here. So what companions must it have? Ignorance and karma, right? So these three produce rebirth. So what does ignorance do? Blindfolds, okay. And what does craving do? It turns the person to so that means it makes a person attached to attached to the existence or like the existence. And what does karma do? It pushes him into the precipice. That means it produces the rebirth in the next existence. So now we have gone through two noble truths. That means two truths discovered and penetrated and also taught by the Buddha. The first noble truth is like what? A simile. You're not sure? The first noble truth is like a disease, right? And the second noble truth is like the cause of the disease. So let us say Buddha was a doctor, a physician, and the world is the patient. So Buddha examined the patient, the world, and then found out that this world had the disease of dukkha or suffering. And then Buddha said, there is also the cause of this disease, cause of this suffering. Then the patient wants to know whether this disease can be cured, whether there can be disappearance of or cessation of this disease. So in order to give consolation to the patient, the world, Buddha said, there is the cessation of suffering. And that is the third noble truth. So the third noble truth is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the stopping of suffering, or the disappearance of suffering. But when Buddha described the third noble truth, he said it is the cessation of that very craving. Can you find that passage? Let me see. Yesterday's lesson was about the beginning of yesterday's lesson. Yes. Four noble truths. Yes. So here both the equation is cessation of craving equals cessation of dukkha, right? So Buddha describes cessation of dukkha as cessation of craving. Buddha did not say disappearance of dukkha is cessation of dukkha, but he said the cessation of craving is the cessation of dukkha. That means only when craving is removed can there be cessation of dukkha. Because we have to deal with the cause if we want to get rid of the effect. So we cannot deal with the effect if we don't want the effect. We must deal with the cause. So Buddha here said the cessation of dukkha is the cessation of craving or tanha. And here our commentator said Buddhas are like lions. So the lions always attack the real enemy or real source of the danger. But the other teachers are like dogs. Now when you throw a stone at the dog will follow the stone and not you, right? You throw a stone at the dog and then he will go after the stone but not after you. So the those that belong to other faiths act like that, because when they practice mortification of the body as a means to eradicate mental defilements, now they are dealing with the effects and not the cause. The cause of suffering is tanha, but they do not do anything about tanha, but they are just afflicting their bodies. So, you know the word mortification? So they inflict suffering on themselves. They lying on the spikes, you know the spikes, thorns, lying on the thorns, or standing for a long time, and sitting in the sun, in the middle of full fires and so on. They think that if they do like that, their mental defilements will go dry. But actually, that is not true. Because they are dealing with the effect and not with the cause. Now, Buddha always deal with the cause and not with the effect. So that is why here, Buddha said, the cessation of suffering is the cessation of That same craving means that craving described as producing rebirth and so on. And it is the total cessation, cessation without any remainder, cessation without any remainder is called the third noble truth. Sometimes something may cease, but they may leave something, some residue. But here, cessation means total cessation. Total cessation means once they are removed, they will not come back again. And that is very important. Only this kind of removal can stop suffering. Suppose you are paying homage to the Buddha. So at that moment, there are no mental defilements in your mind. So you are preventing mental defilements from arising in your mind at that moment. So your mind is pure. But it is pure only when you are paying homage to the Buddha. You get up from that place and then you find someone who provokes you and then you will get angry, right? So anger can come back. Although at the moment when you are paying respects to the Buddha, you have no anger, it can come back when there are conditions for it. And with the practice of jhana, with the practice of samadhi, you can keep these away, the mental defilements away from your mind for some time, some longer time, but not total eradication. You may get jhana and you may be in jhana for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours and so on. So during those 3 hours or one or two or 3 hours, your mind is pure. There are no mental defilements. But you get out of jhana and again you find something provoking and you will get angry and so on. So they can come back. But eradication at the moment of enlightenment is total eradication, absolute eradication. Once eradicated at the moment of enlightenment, these mental defilements will never arise in your mind again. So among these here, the cessation without remainder means that kind of cessation, the total cessation. Once ceased, they will not come back again. So the third noble truth is cessation of suffering, and cessation of suffering means just Nibbana. So the third noble truth is actually Nibbana. So Nibbana is called Nirodha or cessation because it is the cause for cessation. Cause for cessation means at the moment of enlightenment, Nibbana serves as the object for the path consciousness to arise. Okay, now let us talk about enlightenment. What is enlightenment? What happens at the moment of enlightenment? Enlightenment comes to a person who practices vipassana meditation. So without vipassana meditation, there can be no enlightenment. Suppose a person is practicing vipassana meditation and he goes through different stages of vipassana knowledge one by one, one by one. And when his vipassana meditation becomes mature, then a type of consciousness arises in his mind. That consciousness he has never experienced before. Now, we have different types of consciousness. We experience different types of consciousness. Sometimes wholesome consciousness, sometimes unwholesome consciousness. But that consciousness that arises at the moment of enlightenment is a special kind of consciousness, and that consciousness he has never experienced before. So that consciousness is called Magga, M-A-G-G-A. Magga is translated as path. So it is called path consciousness. When that consciousness arises, that consciousness takes Nibbana as object. And it is that Magga consciousness that eradicates the mental defilements. So what we mean by enlightenment is that arising of Magga consciousness, and Magga consciousness taking Nibbana as object, and Magga consciousness eradicating mental defilements. That is what we call enlightenment. So, what constitutes enlightenment? What is enlightenment? Three things in enlightenment. Arising of path consciousness. And that is one element of enlightenment. And the second one is that path consciousness taking Nibbana as object. That is another element. And then the third one is that consciousness eradicating mental defilements. And eradicating means destroying totally. So they will, the mental defilements eradicated will never arise again in that person. So that is what we call enlightenment. So in order for the path consciousness to arise, there must be Nibbana. Because path consciousness takes Nibbana as object. Object means something you hold on to, your consciousness holds on to. Now, this is the microphone. I'm looking at the microphone, and there is seeing in me, right? So, this microphone is the object of my seeing. So, this is called an object. Now, you are hearing my voice. My voice is the object of your hearing. Now, you think of something. And then that thing in your mind is the object of your thinking. Now you know what object is. So path consciousness takes Nibbana as object, that cessation of dukkha as object. If there were no Nibbana, there can be no Magga consciousness, because Magga consciousness always takes Nibbana as object. So Nibbana serves as object for Magga Chitta to arise, and it is the Magga Chitta that eradicates the mental defilements. So here, Nibbana is described as cessation of suffering means it is the cause of cessation of suffering. Cause means not producing something, but serving as a condition, serving as a cause for Magga consciousness to eradicate. So you understand this? If there were no Nibbana, Magga Chitta, Magga consciousness cannot arise, right? Because Magga consciousness must take Nibbana as object. Since without Nibbana, Magga Chitta cannot arise, there can be no eradication of mental defilements without Nibbana. Although it is not Nibbana that eradicates mental defilements. It is the Magga consciousness that eradicates mental defilements. You understand? Okay. Since Nibbana serves as the object for Margacitta, that eradicates mental defilements, that gets free from mental defilements and so on, Nibbana is said to be a cause or condition for the cessation of dukkha. So when we say that the third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha, we mean Nibbana is the third noble truth. And many people think that Nibbana is a place to go to. Sometimes people say, or even in the books, it is said that somebody goes to Nibbana or somebody reaches Nibbana. And these are not exact statements, these are figurative speech. Nibbana is not a place to reach. There is no such place as Nibbana. Now, you know that there are 31 planes of existence, human plane, plane of celestial beings, and so on. So altogether there are 31. But Nibbana is not one of these 31 planes. Nibbana is beyond those planes. And Nibbana, we cannot say where Nibbana is, because it has no place. It has no form, no shape, no color. It is just a peaceful state free from both mind and matter, free from mental defilements, free from five aggregates, and so free from dukkha. So it is just a state. And when we say somebody reaches Nibbana, we mean just that person takes Nibbana as object for his consciousness. When a person takes Nibbana as object, I mean, take Nibbana, sees Nibbana directly, then he is said to attain Nibbana. So attainment of Nibbana means not getting Nibbana, like getting something. Say you get something and say you attain something. But here, what is meant is your mind takes Nibbana as object, and that is what we call realizing Nibbana. So realizing Nibbana means not making Nibbana come into being, not producing Nibbana. Nibbana is not a product of anything, but just Nibbana becomes the object of his mind, and that is what we call attainment of Nibbana. Now, there is a question. Can we take Nibbana as object? Now, you pay homage to the Buddha, or you do some merit, say offering food, like offering food today, and then what do you say? What do you wish for? May I attain Nibbana? Something like that. We Buddhists always say, may I attain Nibbana, or may I attain Magga and Phala, right? So when you say, may I attain Nibbana, can you take Nibbana as object, or do you take Nibbana as object at that moment? Yeah? Yes or no? Yes. The Nibbana that you take as object, when you say may I attain Nibbana, is not the real Nibbana. It is a concept, because you have heard that Nibbana is a cessation of suffering, Nibbana is a state to wish for, and so you say may I attain Nibbana, right? So the Nibbana that you take as object is not the real Nibbana, an imitation of that Nibbana. So the real Nibbana can be taken as object only at the moment of enlightenment. And after that moment of enlightenment, if that person wants to take Nibbana as object again, then he can enter into what is called phalasamapatti, attainment of fruition. So during that phalasamapatti, it is like a jhana. So during the time when he is in phalasamapatti, his mind is totally on Nibbana. Now Nibbana is a very peaceful state. When your mind takes Nibbana as object, your mind also becomes very peaceful. That is why those who have attained enlightenment want to go into that attainment as often as they can, because for them the samsara is like a burning house. They want to get out of this samsara as soon as possible. But so long as they are living, they have to be in this samsara. But even though they are in the samsara, sometimes they want to take a vacation from samsara. So in order to take a vacation from samsara, they get into that kind of attainment called phalasamapatti. So during the time when they are in the attainment of phala, their mind is totally on Nibbana, which is a very peaceful state. So when the mind takes the very peaceful state, the mind also becomes peaceful. Now you think of something disturbing, and your mind becomes disturbed, right? Yes, you think of something peaceful, and your mind becomes peaceful. When your mind becomes peaceful, your body also becomes peaceful. So those who have attained enlightenment often go into that kind of attainment or the phalasamapatti in order to get away from suffering as much as possible in the world. So Nibbana is not a place to go to, and not a thing, not anything at all, right? We cannot describe Nibbana adequately, because Nibbana is beyond all description. Even when we call Nibbana is a state, we do not mean that Nibbana has existence. When we say something exists, we mean that it comes into being and it stays for some time and then it disappears. So there are three stages of existence. The first one is arising or coming into being. The second one is standing for some time, existing for some time. And then the third is disappearing. So these three are called the characteristic of conditioned phenomena. So all conditioned phenomena has these three stages of existence. So when we say something exists, we mean that it comes into being, it stays for some time, and then it disappears and it is no more. So if we say Nibbana exists, then we might mean that Nibbana has a beginning and then Nibbana has an end. So Nibbana is not permanent, Nibbana is also impermanent. So we do not mean that. So that is why we do not say Nibbana exists. So some teachers say Nibbana is, but it does not exist. Nibbana is something there, right? But we do not describe it as existing. But it is not nothingness. You may take an example of health. What is health? Health means no disease, right? So you have no disease, and that is called health. So it is a kind of state, but we do not see health as a beginning or an end. But health is a state, and it is a positive state, right? To be healthy is positive or negative? Positive. So health is a positive state. But when we define health, we say, oh, health means absence of disease, right? So we describe a positive state with negative words. Because this is the only way we can describe health. In the same way, nirvana is a positive state, but it is often described with negative words. Deathless. Deathless means not dying, something like that. So, the nirvana we take as object when we say, may I attain nirvana and so on, is not the real nirvana. So the real nirvana can be taken only by the path consciousness. And that path consciousness at the enlightenment moment is immediately followed by two or three moments of fruition consciousness. You may have heard about or read words like Maggaphala, Maggaphala Nibbana. Phala, the fruition is phala, and fruition immediately follows the Magga. So there is no gap, no interval between Magga and phala at the first attainment of Magga. And those phala moments also take Nibbana as object. Directly take Nibbana as object, like the Magga consciousness. So, in the process of enlightenment, the real point of enlightenment is the Magga consciousness. And this Magga consciousness is immediately followed by two or three moments of Phala consciousness. And Phala consciousness also take Nibbana as object. And Magga and Phala consciousness are called supramundane consciousness. They do not belong to this world. They belong beyond this world. Beyond this world means beyond the five aggregates of clinging. So they are called supramundane consciousness. The object of the supramundane consciousness is always Nibbana. And this Nibbana is here the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. So it is like the cure of the disease. So this is the third noble truth. The third noble truth, which is Nibbana, can be described as of two kinds. One is Nibbana, which is evident while the aggregates are remaining. And the other one is the Nibbana, which is evident when there are no remainder of aggregates. Suppose a person becomes an arahant. When he becomes an arahant, his mental defilements are all eradicated. So the destruction of mental defilement at the moment when a person becomes an arahant is called one kind of nibbana. It is called nibbana of mental defilement. I mean, nibbana means, let us just call cessation, cessation of mental defilement. So, after he becomes an arahant, he has no mental defilement. But he still has this body. He still has other types of consciousness. So these aggregates are remaining with him. So when a person becomes an arahant, and before his death, he may experience nirvana again and again and again. So the nirvana he experiences when he is alive, before he dies, is called one kind of nirvana. Nirvana with the aggregates remaining. And when an arahant dies, he dies, he disappears like a flame of a lamp. So when the flame of a lamp goes out, can you say where it goes? No. Can you say it is now here or it is now there? No, it just goes out. In the same way, when an arahant dies, he just disappears. We cannot say he is now here, he is now there. Because the remaining aggregates have all ceased. So at that moment, the nibbana that is evident is called nibbana without the remaining aggregates. So there are two kinds of nibbanas. Actually, not two different kinds, but by way of giving names, then we can call the first kind of nibbana as nibbana with aggregates remaining, and the second one as nibbana with without aggregates remaining. So nibbana with aggregates remaining is experienced by arahants before they die. And nibbana without aggregates remaining becomes evident after the death of the arahants. We do not say that the second nibbana is experienced by arahants after they die, because after they die they are no more. There can be no experience. Okay, now this is the third noble truth. Now when we hear the third noble truth, we are encouraged, right? First Buddha said, oh, it is all dukkha. So it is very depressing. But Buddha also said, oh, there is a cause of dukkha. I have found the cause of dukkha. And this dukkha can be cured. This dukkha can cease. Then we are encouraged. And then, what we will ask Buddha? The Buddha is now saying, there is dukkha, there is the cause of dukkha, and there is the cessation of dukkha. And we want to get out of this dukkha. So, what question will we ask the Buddha? Yeah, how can we stop suffering? How can we achieve cessation of suffering? Or what must we do to get cessation of suffering, right? So, if you are a patient, and the doctor says you have this disease, and there is a cause for the disease, this disease can be cured, what is the next question? What medicine must I take, right? What is your prescription, right? So as a prescription, Buddha gave us the fourth noble truth. And the fourth noble truth has a long name. What is the name of the fourth noble truth? The noble truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering. So the noble truth of the way. So in brief, we call it Magga Satya. Magga truth. Now, I want you to be familiar with the Pali terms of these four noble truths. Now, the first is dukkha. The second is dukkha samudaya. And the third is dukkha nirodha. And the fourth is a long name. Dukkha nirodha kamini patibada. Dukkha nirodha kamini, G-A-M-I-N-I, and then patibada, P-A-T-I-P-A-D-A. Dukkha nirodha gamini patibada. G-A, long A. Gamini patibada. So, dukkha means suffering, right? Nirodha means cessation. So, dukkha nirodha means cessation of suffering. Gamini means going, actually. Going to cessation of suffering. And patibada means practice or way. So the practice that goes to the cessation of suffering. Here also the language is figurative. Actually, it does not go to cessation of suffering, it does not go to nirvana, but it takes nirvana as object. So taking nirvana as object is described here as going. So the word leading to may not be accurate. Leading to the cessation of suffering and going to cessation of suffering. I think going to cessation of suffering is better. That means that goes to the cessation of suffering, that takes cessation of suffering as object. So this is the prescription, this is the medicine Buddha gave to the patient of dukkha disease. And this prescription is made up of 8 ingredients. Now when a doctor makes medicine, nowadays they don't make, they just give you from the bottle. But in the olden days, they have to prepare the medicine for themselves. Then they may mix the ingredients, 2 ingredients, 3 ingredients, and 4 or so on. And then they will give it to the patient. So here also Buddha gave us this medicine, the fourth noble truth medicine. And it is made up of 8 ingredients. So there must be 8 things in this medicine. And what are those 8? They are called 8 factors of path. Now go to 75. But, the beginning of yesterday's, they may not be given in full, because it is so familiar with the readers that they will just give 1 or 2 and then like ellipsis. Samadhi and so on, right understanding? 8 rights. Right. So if you go to 75, you'll find them in detail. 76? Right view, that is number 1. Now you can write them down. 1, right view. 2, I think you write the, you don't have the Pali there? No, okay. Then the second one, right thinking or right thought. And number three, right speech. Number four, number five, right livelihood. Okay, number six, right effort. Number seven, right mindfulness. And number eight, right concentration. So these are the eight ingredients that make up the fourth noble truth, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And these eight are called by a popular name, and that name is Eightfold Path, Noble Eightfold Path. Eightfold means consisting of eight things. So these eight ingredients as a group are called the Fourth Noble Truth, the Noble Truth of the way that leads to the cessation of suffering. So number one is what? Right view. Right view means right understanding. There can be different kinds of right understanding, and as the fourth noble truth, they must all arise at the moment of enlightenment. They must all arise with Magga consciousness. So when the Magga consciousness arises, it arises with many mental states, many mental factors. Actually, there are 36 of them, and among them, there are these eight mental factors. They are called Chetasikas. And these eight mental factors are called Magga, actually, path. So the name path is the name of these eight taken together. And each one of them is called the factor of path. So you should understand path, factor of path, and path consciousness. What is path? What is path? Eight factors as a whole. A group of eight factors, or sometimes it may be seven. Let us say just eight. So a group of eight factors is called path, or in Pali, Magga. And each one of them is called a factor of path, or path factor. And consciousness that these factors accompany is called path consciousness. So you should understand clearly these three. Path, path factor, path consciousness. A consciousness accompanied by these factors. So right view really means knowledge, panya. Right view means right knowledge or right understanding or wisdom, panya. And this panya here eradicates the ignorance. When it eradicates ignorance, it eradicates other mental defilements as well. So if you read 76, you'll find that. Can you read 76? Yes.
very often. But the meditation is proven into the penetration of the Buddhist truth. If I understand in Nirvana as an object, the listener is the key to ignorance, and that is right view.
Right. So, well, now you see, right view takes Nirvana as object. It mentions there. And it is wisdom or understanding. So when we say right view, we mean the understanding. Or in Pali, it is Panya. And here, since it arises with Magga consciousness, it eradicates all mental defilements. And the ignorance is at the head of these mental defilements. So here, right view means right understanding. That eradicates mental defilements, and that takes Nirvana as object. Now, 77.
When he possesses such means, the directing of the mind unto Nirvana, which directing associated with that right view, abolishes wrong thinking, and that is right thinking.
Yeah, right thinking here means, again, a mental state that arises at the moment of enlightenment. Since it is right thinking, it abolishes wrong thinking. Wrong thinking means thinking to harm others, to kill others, to harm others, and so on. And there is one word that is very important. You can read it again. Right, direction of the mind on Nibbana. Okay. Now, this factor, right thinking or right thought, as it is translated in English, is actually misleading. Because when it is called right thought, you must be thinking something like that, right? But here, right thought means not thinking. At the moment of enlightenment, there is no thinking. No thinking as we ordinarily think. There is the activity of mind, but it is not thinking about this thing or that thing. So this, the right thought here means a mental factor that directs the mind, or that takes the mind to the object and put it on the object. Directing the mind to the object, right? Actually, not just directing. Directing means you may show someone to go to some place, right? Say you may point your finger and say, go to that building. And you may not take him there. But here, directing means not just giving directions, but taking the mind and putting it on the object. So this mental factor is an important factor. If it does not take the mind and put it on the object, how can mind take the object? Suppose I'm visiting this city, right? I don't know where to go. Then somebody takes me and put me in a place where I want to go. Without him, I cannot go there. And I will not experience that place, right? So in the same way, this mental factor takes the mind and put it on the object here, Nibbana. So when mind is put on the object, then mind can experience that object. So that mental factor that takes the mind and put it on the object is what is called right thought here. Not just thinking. Okay. So if it does not put the mind on the object, mind cannot be on the object, and so mind cannot know the object, right? So it is beneficial to right view. Right view can understand or see Nibbana only when the mind is put on the object. So that is why these two are grouped together, and they are called a group of wisdom. The eight factors will be grouped into three later on. In the next hour, I'll explain it to you. So there will be three groups. These eight will be divided into three groups. So the first group consists of these first two, the right view and right thought. And right thought is grouped together with right view as the group of wisdom because it is beneficial to wisdom. That means if it does not take the object and put it on the, if it does not take the consciousness and put it on the object, there can be no understanding, there can be no right view. So these two are grouped together as belonging to the group of wisdom. So now you got the first two. What is number one? Right view. And number two? Right thinking, right thought. Now number three is right speech. And right speech actually means abstention from wrong speech. Abstention from wrong speech. Now when you say, I take the precept of abstention from wrong speech, there is this factor, sammavacha, right speech. So right speech really means abstention from wrong speech. And you know the wrong speech? How many wrong speeches are there? One more. Harsh speech and idle talk. Yeah, these are called wrong speech. So abstention from wrong speech is called right speech. And the next one? Right action means abstention from wrong action. There are three wrong actions mentioned in the books. And what are these three? No, you will not find in the book. Right. So abstention from these three things is called, in Pali, sammakammanta, right action. And then the third one, right livelihood. Right livelihood is abstention from wrong livelihood. Now there are some traits that are said to be wrong, like selling weapons, selling poisons, selling liquor, and so on. So they are called wrong livelihood. So abstention from wrong livelihood is called right livelihood. And for monks, right livelihood means acquiring requisites by lawful means. That means monks are not to tell fortune, monks are not to give medicine, to act like doctors and so on, to get donations from people. So they must go out for alms, picking up their bowls and go out for alms and so on. So this the third one, right livelihood, means abstention from wrong livelihood. And also there is one thing you need to understand regarding these three. The first one is abstention from wrong speech. The second one is abstention from wrong action. And the third one is abstention from wrong livelihood. Now there is another meaning to them. If you abstain from wrong speech, just abstain from wrong speech, then there is right speech in your mind, this factor. But suppose your livelihood is telling lies, let us say, you tell lies to earn a living, so your way of livelihood is telling lies, and then you abstain from telling lies, then what will happen? What will arise? The first one or the third one? If you abstain from lying ordinarily, lying that is not your livelihood, then you are having right speech. But if you abstain from lying, which is your livelihood, then you are having right livelihood. So there is this difference. Suppose a fisherman, right? So his livelihood is killing fish. So if he abstains from killing fish, he gets not right action, but right livelihood. Because it is his livelihood, and he abstains from his livelihood, which is, in his case, killing. But a person, sometimes a person goes for fishing for fun, and then somebody tells him that it is not good to do, and then he abstains from killing. Then he gets right action. So right speech and right action are abstention from the wrong action and wrong speech. That is not one's livelihood. But if these are his livelihood and he abstains from them, then he gets the right livelihood and not the first two. So that is also important. So although the name is right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the real meaning to understand is abstention. That is why they are grouped as sila. Sila group. These three are grouped as sila. Then we come to the next group. What is the next? After right livelihood, there is 81, right effort. Right effort means making effort. Right effort cuts off laziness, right? You may find that in 81. Right,
81.
Yes. So, actually, the making effort, is called right effort. So, making effort means here, getting rid of laziness, getting rid of idleness, and making effort for the abandoning of akusala already arisen, and also for not doing akusala that has not yet arisen, and making effort to do kusala that you have not practiced before, and also making effort for the development of the kusala that you have done. So there are four aspects of right effort. Now, two regarding akusala and two regarding kusala. Now, akusala, let us say akusala. You have done some akusala. And then you try to get rid of that akusala that has already arisen in you. So that is one kind of effort. And another effort is to refrain from doing kusala that you have not done before. Now let us say old akusala and new akusala, right? To get rid of old akusala, one effort. And not to do new akusala, that is another kind of effort. Similarly with kusala. To do kusala that is that you have not done before, and to do again and again the kusala you have done before. So trying in that way, making effort in that way, is called right effort. And after right effort, there is right mindfulness. Now you know right mindfulness very well, don't you? You practice mindfulness before? Very good, yes. So, mindfulness means what? You know what mindfulness is?
Mindful.
Huh? To be mindful. To be fully aware. To be fully aware of the object is what we call mindfulness. So in order to be mindful, you make notes, right? When you see something, you say seeing, seeing, seeing. When the abdomen is rising, you say rising, rising. And when it falls, falling, falling, right? So that means you are trying to be mindful. You are trying to be mindful of the rising and falling of the abdomen. You are trying to be mindful of the seeing, hearing, and so on. So to be mindful means to be fully aware of the object, not superficial awareness. It must be a deep awareness. And it is also called not losing the object. When you have good siddhi, you do not lose the object. If you have no good siddhi, you lose the object, and that is why you forget. Sometimes we forget many things. When we forget, that thing is not in our mind. We have lost it, right? So sati is opposite of that. When there is sati, you do not lose the object. The object is with you. So sati is one of the eight factors. And then the last one is called right concentration. So concentration means mind having one object. Mind not going to different objects, but mind being on one object. So that is what we call right concentration here. So now we get the last three. The first one is what? Right effort. Second one? Right mindfulness. And the third one? Right concentration. These three are grouped as concentration group. In the beginning, you wrote down the eight factors. Now you can make marks there. 1 and 2, what? Wisdom. Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 3, 4, 5. Sila. And 6, 7, 8. Concentration group. So in this group, what is prominent is concentration. But concentration cannot arise if there is no mindfulness. Now you must make note of it. Now when you practice with meditation, you need to get concentration. In order to get concentration, you must have mindfulness. If you are not mindful, if you do not practice mindfulness, you cannot get concentration. And in order to be mindful, you have to make effort. If you do not make effort, you cannot be mindful. So in order to be mindful, you say, seeing, 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 hearing, hearing, rising, falling, and so on. So you have to make effort to be mindful, and only when you are mindful can you get concentration. So this group has concentration as the prominent factor, but the other two are also included in this group. Not that they are concentration, but they help the concentration. So these two help concentration. That means you have to practice effort and mindfulness to get concentration. So these three are grouped as concentration group. So let us go back to the eight factors. There are eight factors, and the first factor is right view, and second, right thought, and right thinking, and the third, right speech, fourth, right action, fifth, right livelihood, sixth, right effort, seventh, right mindfulness, and eighth, right concentration. And then the groupings. Number 1 and 2, wisdom. Yes. Good. Can you tell me without looking at your notes? Yes.
8, 4, and 5.
You're good.
6, 7, 8.
Concentration group, right? Okay. Now, although the order given here begins with right view, right? When you practice, you begin with 3, 4, 5. 3, 4, 5, and then 6, 7, 8, and then, yeah, 3, 4, 5, and then 6, 7, 8, and then 1, 2, like that. Because you begin with sila. And then through sila, and you practice samadhi, and then you reach panya. So the order of practice is to begin with right speech and so on. Now that is why when you practice meditation, it is important that your sila is pure. If you do not have purity of sila, you cannot hope to get concentration. Because if your sila is not pure, you have self-blame. So you blame yourself. My sila is not pure, I have done this wrong thing and that wrong thing and so on. And so thinking about that is called remorse. So that remorseful thinking can interfere with your practice. Now when you practice meditation, you want to be very, very pure. You want to keep your mind very pure. And it is the time when these thoughts come to you, interfere with your meditation. So you cannot meditate well, and so you cannot get concentration. So it is important that you first practice purity of sila, the middle three, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Now, how do you achieve purity of sila? What must you do to get purity of sila? Okay, you take precepts, right? Panadibata, viramanisika, patang samadhiyami, and so on. So you take the precepts and you keep them, then your moral conduct or sila is pure. So to purify your sila, before you practice meditation, you take precepts. And after taking precepts, you can be sure that your sila is pure. You don't have to worry about impurity of sila in the past. But right at this moment, your sila needs to be really pure. So in order to beautify your sila right at this moment, what must you do? Take precepts and keep them. So that is one important thing or preliminary action you have to do before you practice meditation. After you are sure that your sila is pure, you can begin with your practice of meditation. You can begin with the practice of mindfulness. So you make effort and so on. So these eight are grouped into three: sila, samadhi, and panya. Now, why are there three steps? So these eight are grouped into three: sila, samadhi, and panya. Now, why are there three steps instead of just one? Why are there three? Why are the path to enlightenment described on these three steps? Why are there three steps? You're not sure. Okay. Now, in order to attack the three levels of mental defilement, these three steps are given by the Buddha. Let us say we are fighting a battle, right? There are three kinds of enemies. So Buddha gives us the weapons that we can attack, that we can kill these three kinds of enemies. They are different kinds of enemies. So now we have mental defilements. Huh? You have mental defilements, I have mental defilements. There are three levels of mental defilements. The first level is called the latent level, or sleeping level, we may call it. That means they lie latent in our minds. They do not come up yet, but they lie sleeping, let us say, sleeping in our minds. That is one level. And the next level is, now they come up, they arise in our minds. So arising level. And then after they come up, we may act upon them. Suppose I am angry, and through anger I will attack somebody, I will even kill somebody. So that means I reach the stage of transgression. So there are three levels. Now, latent level, arising level, and transgression level. latent level we all have, because we are liable to get angry, we are liable to be attached to things and so on. In order to attack, in order to deal with the transgression level, Buddha gave us sila. Suppose there is an occasion for you to kill a living being. But you have taken the precepts. So you abstain from killing the living being. So killing means transgression. So that transgression level mental defilement you are able to prevent by sila. So long as you have taken the precepts and you keep them, you will not come to transgression. You can prevent transgression. You may not kill, you will not steal, you will not practice sexual misconduct, and so on. So in order to deal with that transgression level, Buddha gave us sila. So long as you have taken the precepts and keep them, you can prevent that transgression level mental defilements. You understand? But that is not enough for us to reach enlightenment. In order to reach enlightenment, we have to clean our minds of the mental defilements. So suppose we have sila, and so we do not kill, we do not steal. But although we do not kill, we do not steal, in our minds, sometimes we may have desire to kill, or I will get angry, or I will want to possess other people's property, and so on. So in order to avoid such mental defilements from arising in our minds, Buddha gave us the samadhi level. When you practice meditation, how can these mental defilements arise in your mind? Well, you are making notes as rising, falling, or seeing, hearing, touching, sitting, and so on. So when you're making these notes, how can these mental defilements arise in your mind? There is no chance for them to arise. So by practicing vipassana, by practicing samadhi, by practicing meditation, you are keeping them, these mental defilements, a little distance away from you. You are preventing them from arising in your mind. You are preventing them from coming up on the to the surface of your mind. So that you can do only with meditation or samadhi. So in order to deal with the second level of mental defilement, the arising level, Buddha gave us the samadhi practice. So with samadhi, let us say now we are able to keep them from arising. But still, we have liability to anger and so on. Because when there are conditions, they will come up again. Although, when we are practicing meditation, they do not come up. And after meditation, when there are conditions for them to arise, then they will arise. Because we have not eradicated these mental defilements altogether. We still have the liability to get angry, to get attached to things. So in order to deal with that deepest level of mental defilements, Buddha gave us panya, wisdom. Only by wisdom can the mental defilements, or can the latent level of mental defilement be eradicated. Now you go back to 76. What do you find there? Ignorance. Latent ignorance or something. The eye of wisdom. Right. Inherent. Inherent what? Yeah. So that inherent tendency means that deepest level. So that means, although it is not arising now, it is lying deep in our mind, ready to come up whenever there is the condition for them. It is like fire in the match, a box of matches. Now, there is actually no fire in the box of matches, right? If there is fire, it will be burning now. But it has the potential to burn. And then you strike the stick there, and then there is fire, right? So we may say that the matchbox has the potential to burn. But it is not burning now. So the condition is striking. So you strike a match and then there is fire. So in the same way, although they are not present in our minds, we have this liability to get angry and so on. We have this inherent tendency of ignorance, attachment, anger and so on. So in order to attack that deepest level, we have to practice vipassana. We have to practice panya. So only panya can eradicate that deepest level of mental defilements. That is why these three steps are taught by the Buddha. So in order to attack the three levels of mental defilements, Buddha gave us these three levels of practice. And these three levels are sila level, samadhi level, and panya level. Now, the eight factors mentioned as the fourth noble truth arise at the moment of Magga consciousness. That means at the moment of enlightenment. But what about moments before enlightenment? Now we all want to get enlightenment and we practice. So when we are practicing, what about these eight? Are we practicing these eight factors or not? Here, right, in this explanation, these eight factors are called the fourth noble truth, and these eight factors are those that arise with Magga consciousness. Magga consciousness is actually a fruit of vipassana meditation. Although it is not called a resultant consciousness, it is actually a fruit of vipassana meditation. So these eight factors here are the fruit. But how? In order to get that fruit, we must do something, right? In order to get the fruit, you must grow a tree and so on. So when we are practicing vipassana meditation, are we following the fourth noble truth? Are we following the Noble Eightfold Path or not. No, I am not asking whether you try to or not. Are you practicing the Noble Eightfold Path when you are practicing Vipassana meditation? Now you have to understand that there are two kinds of the Eightfold Path. The real Eightfold Path at the moment of enlightenment and preliminary Eightfold Path preceding the real Eightfold Path. So two kinds of Eightfold Path. The real Eightfold Path that arises at the moment of enlightenment or magga. And then the preliminary Eightfold Path that leads to the magga consciousness, and that leads to the moment of enlightenment. So what we practice when we practice Vipassana meditation is that preliminary Eightfold Path, not the real Eightfold Path. Actually, the real Eightfold Path is the outcome or the fruit of the preliminary Eightfold Path. Now, you must understand this clearly. Otherwise, it would not make sense, because the eight factors mentioned here are the outcome of the practice. So, somebody may say, we are not practicing Noble Eightfold Path when we are practicing Vipassana, because Noble Eightfold Path is available only at the moment of enlightenment. So what we practice when we practice Vipassana meditation is called what? Preliminary Eightfold Path. That preliminary Eightfold Path we practice, or we must practice. Now, when you practice Vipassana meditation, can you see these factors working? So when you take the precepts, you are practicing the three middle ones, right? The right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Suppose you take precepts and now you sit down and you practice meditation. So when you practice meditation, you try to be mindful, right? And in order to be mindful, you have to make effort. If you do not make effort, you cannot be mindful. So that effort is what? The right effort here. And then you practice mindfulness and say, rising, falling, rising, falling, rising, falling, sitting, touching, and so on. So your mind goes to the object and hit the object whenever there is an object. So that hitting the object is mindfulness. So your mindfulness hit this object, your mindfulness hits that object, and so on. So mindfulness is also involved in your practice. And then when your mindfulness becomes stronger, your mind, as it were, goes into the object, or your mind, as it were, sticks to the object. And that is what we call samadhi, concentration. So with the help of mindfulness, your mind becomes concentrated. Your mind can stay on one object only. And when your mind becomes concentrated, you begin to see things clearly. Now, our mind ordinarily is like a muddy water. So you put the muddy water in the glass, and you cannot see what is in the water, because it is muddy. Then you put it there, and then the particles of mud settle down, and then it becomes clear. So when it becomes clear, you see what are there, right? So in the same way, there are what are called mental hindrances in our minds, sensual desire, ill will, sleepiness, worry, anxiety, doubt, and so on. So long as these mental hindrances are in our minds, we cannot see things clearly. By the practice of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, these mental hindrances are subdued, or they settle down. So when they are subdued, mind becomes clear. So when mind becomes clear, you see things clearly. Now you see objects very clearly, very vividly, as though you are seeing the real thing with your eyes open. And when you see things clearly, you also see what they are, what this thing is. If you do not see a thing clearly, you do not know what this is. But now you see it clearly, and so you see this what it is, and also you see the details of this object also. And then you also see that this object just arises and disappears. It does not last for a long time. So whatever object you take, first you see it clearly, because now your mind is free from mental hindrances. You see it clearly, and then you see what it is. And you also see that it arises and disappears. So when you see that object arise and disappear, you know this is impermanent. When you know this is impermanent, you know that this is dukkha. Because whatever is impermanent is dukkha, according to the Buddha. And this dukkha, you cannot turn into sukha or happiness. It comes and goes by itself, and so there is no control over it, and so you see the anatta nature of things through vipassana. So when you practice vipassana, these factors are working actively in your mind. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and right understanding. And right understanding can come only when there is right thought. Right thought means the mental factor that puts the mind on the object. So, at every moment of good meditation, these five factors are working actively. Five means right effort, right concentration, right mindfulness, right concentration, right thought, right view, right thought. Now the other three that belong to sila are not actively participating, but they are already accomplished. When you take the precepts, you take them with the intention of keeping them, right? You have no intention of breaking them when you take them. So after you take the precepts, then they are already accomplished. They will no longer be working actively because they are already accomplished. But the other five are participating actively. And so these five are called worker factors or working factors. These five must always be present in your mind when you practice vipassana meditation. So in the beginning, right view may not come yet. But before you see the thing clearly, how can you know that it is impermanent and so on, right? So in the beginning, before you get good concentration, that right view may not be present. But there are other kinds of right view also. That is the understanding of the law of karma, understanding that there is karma and there is the result of karma, and that is also called right view. And understanding the objects as anicca, dukkha, and anatta is also called right view. So right view, there are many kinds of right view. The understanding of karma and results, understanding of the three characteristics, and then right view at the moment of heart consciousness, right view at the moment of fruition consciousness, and so on. So the real right view may not be present in the beginning stages of vipassana. That is, before you get concentration and before you see the objects clearly. And from the moment you are able to subdue the mental hindrances and your mind becomes clear and concentrated, you will begin to see the objects clearly and so on. And from that moment, the factor of right view will come into your mind. So, when you practice vipassana meditation, you are following or you are practicing the fourth noble truth, the noble truth of the path that goes to the cessation of suffering. So what one must do in order to follow the fourth noble truth? Yeah, so in order to follow the Eightfold Path, what must you do? Yeah? So, in order to have right effort and so on, what do you do? Right. You have to practice, right? Then there are two kinds of practices, samatha meditation and vipassana meditation. So which one do you prefer? Which one do you want to practice? Vipassana or samatha? Now, samatha meditation leads to strong concentration, and it can lead you to attaining jhanas, and if you are really gifted, you may attain abhinyas and supernormal knowledge. But samatha by itself cannot lead you to understanding the three characteristics, cannot lead you to understanding the nama and rupa clearly. So if your aim is to get free from this samsara, if your aim is for the total purification of your mind, you need to practice vipassana meditation. Without vipassana meditation, total purification of mind cannot be achieved. I am not saying that you are not to practice samatha at all. If you want to, you may practice samatha meditation, but do not be satisfied with just the practice of samatha meditation, even though you may get psychic powers and so on, because they will not lead you to penetrating into the nature of things. They will not lead you to understanding nama and rupa and so on. So Buddha's aim is to all of us to reach nirvana. Buddha's aim is all of us to achieve total purification of mind. Since Buddha's aim is total purification of mind, we should practice vipassana meditation. We may skip samatha meditation, but we cannot skip vipassana. That means we may not practice samatha meditation, but we must definitely practice vipassana meditation. So vipassana meditation is very important, and when we practice vipassana meditation, we are really following the Buddha's advice, or we are really practicing the fourth noble truth, that is the noble truth that leads to the noble truth of the way that leads to the cessation of suffering. In the Satipatthana Sutta, Buddha said, this is the only way. This is the only way for the purification of beings. This is the only way means this middle way, or this Noble Eightfold Path, or this practice of mindfulness. So this is the most important practice for us. And so long as we practice mindfulness meditation, we are prolonging the Buddha Sasana. We are extending the life of Buddha Sasana. Once Buddha was asked, after his death, what will cause his Sasana to endure long, and what will cause his Sasana to endure for a short time? And the Buddha said, so long as there are people who practice mindfulness meditation, the sasana will be prolonged. So by practicing vipassana meditation, by practicing mindfulness meditation, we are prolonging, or we are making the Buddha sasana live longer. At the same time, we are trying to get rid of mental defilements. So we are doing a good service to the Buddha's dispensation when we practice vipassana meditation. And we are honoring him with the best of honor we can do, and with the honor that he, Buddha, likes us to do. Buddha said, honoring him with four requisites is not as good as honoring him with practicing his teachings. So that we must keep in mind, and we try to honor the Buddha as best we can by the practice of mindfulness meditation, by practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. So these four are called the Four Noble Truths. They are called noble because they are discovered by, or penetrated by, or understood by, and revealed by the noblest of the nobles, that is, the Buddha. So first, we must understand the Four Noble Truths in theory, like you do now. And then we must understand the Four Noble Truths with reference to our practice, or through our practice. So when you practice vipassana meditation, you will come to see the Four Noble Truths. Now you will see the Noble Truth of suffering, and you will see the Noble Truth of the origin of suffering, and although you will not see yet the Noble Truth of cessation of suffering, but at the end, when you gain enlightenment, you will see the Third Noble Truth. And the Fourth Noble Truth, you are practicing the preliminary four the Fourth Noble Truth when you are practicing vipassana meditation. And when you reach the stage of enlightenment, then you have done, you have practiced, you have developed the Noble Eightfold Path. So these are the four noble truths taught by the Buddha in the first sermon, in the very first sermon he gave to his five disciples. Well, we will have a break. Yavila. You all right? Now, when Buddha taught Four Noble Truths, it took him about a few minutes. But now, We have been studying the Four Noble Truths for how many hours? 3, 4, 5 hours. Actually, Buddha must have explained in detail. Then is recorded now in the first sermon. So I think only the gist of what Buddha taught was recorded in the first sermon, because they might have asked Buddha questions and Buddha must have explained to them and how to practice and so on. So the doctrine of, or the teachings of the Four Noble Truths is very important in Buddhism, and it is said that whatever Buddha taught can be included in the Four Noble Truths. Because now the First Noble Truth comprises almost all, everything in the world, except just Tanha, right? So Tanha is the Second Noble Truth, and the rest of the world is the First Noble Truth, actually. And then the Third Noble Truth is out of this world, the cessation of suffering or Nibbana. And the Fourth Noble Truth again is in the world, right? The Fourth Noble Truth is a group of 8 factors, and these 8 factors are the mental factors or chetasikas. So they belong to mind. So whatever Buddha taught cannot go out of these Four Noble Truths. We can include any kind of teaching in the Four Noble Truths. And so the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is very important. And not just understanding theoretically, but understanding experientially. So we must try to experience the Four Noble Truths so that we really achieve the total purification of mind. So what is important is total purification of mind. Now many people said they want to attain Nirvana, right? So, and then they think that Nirvana can be attained in the next life. Is that true? Yeah? Now many people, when they pay homage to the Buddha, when they do some meritorious deeds, they say, may we attain Nirvana. And they mean, may we attain Nirvana in the next life, after death. Yeah? When will you attain Nirvana? Next life? Or in this life? Right, very good. So, you can achieve it in this life if you make effort, huh? And sometimes I say to people that don't worry about Nibbana, don't worry about attaining or not attaining Nibbana, but you should aim at the purification of mind. Once you achieve the purification of mind, you attain Nibbana. But Nirvana is a faraway thing and it is difficult to understand. But purification of mind, you can relate to yourself, right? Now you think of your mind and you know your mind has the mental defilement. Now think of a time when your mind will be totally free from mental defilement. How happy you will be at that time? Happy means peacefully happy, not like happy enjoying sensual pleasures, but peacefulness. How peaceful you will be, how happy you will be when your mind is totally pure. When your mind is totally pure, then whatever object you experience, you come across, you will not be affected by those objects. Even though it is very attractive, you will not be attracted to that object. Even though it is very frightening, you will not be afraid of that object. Very bad, then you will not be affected negatively by that object. So, when your mind is totally pure means become incapable of getting angry, getting attached and so on, you will feel very free at that time. Sometimes you want something very much, and that means you become a slave of that thing, right? You want this thing, or you are attached to the thing, you do this thing, and you are under the influence of that thing. Or if you are, if you have too much love for a person also, you are under the influence of that person. Once you can make your mind free from those attachments and so on, you become free. And that freedom from attachment and so on is the thing we should aim at when we practice meditation, or whatever we do, we should aim at achieving that total purification of mind. So once our mind becomes totally pure, we will be the happiest persons in the world. No worry, no anxiety, no depression. Always peaceful. So we should aim at the total purification of mind when we practice vipassana. And you remember the Buddha saying at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, this is the only way for the purification of beings, who Buddha said, right? For the purification of being means for the purification of minds of beings. Buddha did not put Nirvana at the beginning. Right? Only later Buddha said for the attainment of Nirvana. But the first thing Buddha said was for the total purification of mind. So that is the thing we should aim at. if we had paramis in the past, accumulated in the past, then we will be able to achieve total purification in this life. If we cannot, at least we will be able to achieve partial purification. So, to the extent that our mind is pure, we will experience peacefulness or happiness. So, it is for that purpose that we should practice meditation, and also we should aim at achieving the total purification of mind whenever we do some meritorious deeds. So the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is really important, and I'm glad that you're interested in the Four Noble Truths and you want to understand. And I have tried my best to make you understand the Four Noble Truths. But you can read Visuddhimagga if you want to know more about the Four Noble Truths. And I let you bring the book and read the book deliberately, because I can teach without referring to the book, but I want you to be able to find what you want in the book. Now, once you have gone through at least like this, then later when you pick up the book, then you can read and understand. So do not be satisfied with just what I taught to you. But try to learn more about the Four Noble Truths and others from the books like Visuddhimagga and other books. The more you know, and the better you'll be able to understand and practice. Now, you asked me to talk about sila also. You remember that? Now, sila comprises the three middle factors, right? And I told you that sila is the abstention from wrongdoing by bodily actions and speech. Now, sila is the control of bodily actions and speech. and not necessarily of mind. First, you must understand this. The nature of sila is to control your bodily actions and verbal actions. That means just by having unwholesome thoughts, your sila is not broken. There are some people who say, even if you kill a living being in your mind, you are breaking the precept. But that is not true. Because sila concerns with bodily action and verbal action. Only when you kill a being yourself, or you ask another person to kill that living being, do you break that precept. You may have desire, or you may want to kill a living being, but so long as you do not kill it, so long as you do not have another person kill it, you are not breaking the rule. You are not breaking the precept. Although your sila may be not ideally pure, because your mind is now contaminated with hate. But although there is hate in your mind, although you want to kill a living being, so long as you do not do it bodily or by asking other people, your sila is still intact. You are not. You have not broken that precept, so that you must understand. And so, only the abstention from wrong bodily actions and wrong verbal actions can be sila. So, there are the karma that are done in mind only, and those cannot be sila. Although they may be called wrongdoings, they are wrongdoings in your mind, and so they cannot be sila. In your prayer book, I found all abstention of all 10. I think there should be abstention of the first 7 only. You say, I vow to abstain from killing living beings and so on. They are all right. But I vow to abstain from covetousness and so on. They are not in the domain of sila. Although it is good to abstain from covetousness and so on. So they are not to be practiced as sila. And as I said, sila is very important. Purity of sila is important, especially for those who practice meditation. Because sila is a very firm foundation on which we build the structure of samadhi and panya. So there are some people who do not emphasize on the purity of sila, and they may say it's okay to do this or that and so on. But when you are practicing meditation, it should your sila should be really pure. Once a person has taken the refuge, he or she becomes a disciple of the Buddha. So in modern terms, we may say he or she becomes a Buddhist. So after taking the refuge, one becomes a disciple of the Buddha. And so one has to keep the moral precepts that are called precepts for devotees, precepts for upasakas. And it is said that a person who has taken refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and become a disciple of the Buddha should keep 5 precepts. That means every Buddhist is expected to keep these 5 precepts. And you know, you already know these 5 precepts, no? You know the 5 precepts? Abstention from killing, abstention from stealing, abstention from sexual misconduct, abstention from lying, abstention from... So taking intoxicants, drugs, and so on. So these are the 5 precepts all Buddhists are expected to keep. And as I said before, only when you... No, the first one, killing. Only when you kill is this precept broken. Only when you tell a lie is this precept broken, and so on. Just by thinking in your mind, it does not constitute breaking of this sila. Although your sila may be not very pure, right? So, and these 5 precepts are not like commandments in Christianity. They are not the commands of Buddha. Buddha taught these based on comparing oneself with others. Once Buddha went to a place and Brahmins and many people from that place went to the Buddha, and then they said, "Bhante, we are lay people. Now we enjoy the pleasures, and we enjoy good food. We use the best of the perfumes and so on. We use the best clothes. So we are lay people, and we have families. We have children. And please teach us something." So that while being laymen like this, we can gain happiness. And Buddha taught them 7. Buddha taught them 8. 7 precepts. Buddha said, a person who does not want to die, who wants to live. Now, if a person kills another person who wants to live and who does not want to die, that person who is killed will not like it. And if somebody comes to say somebody comes to me and kill me, I don't like it. Since I don't like other people to come and kill me, other people will not like when I go to them and kill them. So considering that or comparing oneself with others, I should abstain from killing and so on. So Buddha's precepts are based on this, comparing oneself with others, not the commandments put down by the Buddha. So in this way, we abstain from killing. I don't want to be killed, right? You don't want to be killed. So if you don't want to be killed, it is fair that you don't kill others. If you don't want to, if you don't want your properties to be stolen, then you should not take other people's property. So in this way, you compare yourself with others and you abstain from stealing and so on. So these 5 precepts are based on comparing oneself with others. And in that way, lay people should keep these 5 precepts. And there are some conditions where one really knows whether a precept is broken or not. For example, killing. Right? So in order to break the precept, then one must know that this is a living being. First, it must be a living being, and then you know that it is a living being. And then you have the intention to kill, and then you make the effort, and the being is killed. So only when these five conditions are fulfilled does that rule is broken, and you come to you commit the offense of killing and something like that. So when these five are not fulfilled, then the akusala karma is not so great. But when these five are fulfilled, then it is called the karma has gone the full course of action. To go to the full course of action means to become a real bad karma. So for a Buddhist, it is important that he or she keep these five precepts as long as he or she lives. There is a saying in Burmese, you should keep the five precepts as you keep your clothes. So we all Buddhists must try to keep these precepts, but sometimes one may be broken. So when you know it is broken, then you take the precepts again. So in that way, you amend the broken precepts. And purity of sila is again, it is very important. And purity of sila can give you joy, it gives you happiness. When your sila is pure, you don't blame yourself. So that is one joy you get. You don't feel remorse. Because you look back, you are moral conduct, and you say it pure, and so you feel joy at it. When you feel joy, you are happy, and when you are happy, your body also becomes comfortable and peaceful, and so you can get samadhi easily. If your sila is not pure, you cannot get samadhi easily. So this samadhi can lead to the penetrating into the nature of things, and so the importance of the purity of sila cannot be overemphasized. Some people may say, "Oh, you are overemphasizing the purity of sila," but no, because purity of sila is a very foundation of our practice, and so it should be kept pure as we keep our clothes always. Now there are some people, they want to change here and there, and then they would say, I abstain from killing living beings as much as I can, something like that. Did you take pieces like that? As best I can, or as much as I can? I tell those people, if you take like that, this is not sila. You have already put conditions there, conditions for breaking the precept. Because I will do as far as I can. That means I may break it if I want to. Right? So I think we should take sila, and we should not make sila that way. Whether you break it or not later, but when you take the sila, it should be just definite, say, I will not, right? I will abstain from killing living beings, like that. So I will abstain from living beings as much as I can. So that is not sila. But nowadays, people want to make sila seem easy to practice, and so they may modify here and there. And also there are some people who say, saying I abstain from killing and so on is negative. We want positive. So they say, I will be compassionate to all beings, instead of saying I abstain from killing. But that is not sila according to our definition. Sila is abstaining from something, abstention from killing, stealing and so on. You say I will have compassion for beings, but that is not sila. That is bhavana, the mental culture. So now some people are doing like that. They want to be positive. What I want to ask them is, if you say abstention from killing living being is negative, then killing living being is positive? No. Sometimes people are led astray by these words, right? Say this is negative, this is positive. And as we found out, the very positive state of Nirvana is described with negative words. So the words may be negative or positive. We don't need to pay much attention to them. But what we should pay attention to is the reality, whether it is really positive or negative. So sometimes people want to change this and that, and so they change the very nature of sila. So when you take sila, be definite and say just, I will refrain from, I take the precept of abstention from killing living beings and stop there, and not say do the best of my ability or something like that. And sometimes you may want to keep more than 5 precepts. How many precepts can you take? Yeah, 5. But sometimes you want to purify yourself more. You want to get more kusala. How many precepts can you take? 8 precepts. So what are the 8 precepts? You high and luxurious, yeah. Do you think you will get more kusala when you take 8 precepts? Probably or definitely. You will definitely get more kusala, right? Now, if you understand Abhidhamma, there can be akusala when eating. Attachment is akusala, unwholesome mental state. So when we eat, we may eat with attachment. When the food is good, right, we eat with greed. So there is attachment there. Now if you don't eat one meal, you avoid attachment for one meal. Yeah? Right? So even when eating, there can be attachment and there can be akusala. Although this akusala may not be very bad, but still it is akusala. So it is better to keep 8 precepts than to keep 5 precepts. But as lay people, you cannot keep 8 precepts always. You have a family, and you have to do business and so on, so you cannot take 8 precepts. But from time to time, you can take 8 precepts, like on holidays. So in Buddhist countries, people take 8 precepts on full moon days and new moon days and on the 8th of the first half and second half of the month. So 4 times a month they keep 8 precepts and so on. And also, read the book and keep 10 precepts if they like, but that is much more difficult. 10 precepts is just 8 precepts plus 1, actually. Because the 7 is divided into 2, and so add 1 and you get 10 precepts, and not handling gold, silver, and money. What? 10 precepts? Yeah, well, it is very rare that lay people take 10 precepts. It is almost impossible for them. But when I went to Jamaica, I met one layman, a Burmese. He said he when other people took 5 precepts, he took 10 precepts. So he said he took 10 precepts every day. Because he had his sons and daughters who would take care of everything for him, and so he's like a monk. So he could take 10 precepts. Otherwise, it is difficult for lay people to keep 10 precepts. So for lay people, the minimum requirement, moral requirement, is 5 precepts. So long as you are pure with regard to 5 precepts, your sila is pure. And when your sila is pure, you can practice meditation any time. And there is another kind of sila which is called sila with right livelihood as the eighth factor. So in that case, you take the first 3, right? And the 4, that is abstention from lying, slandering, harsh speech, and vain talk, and then abstaining from wrong livelihood. So these 8 also some people take. So when you take these 8 precepts, you can take food in the afternoon. you may like that, huh? But you should be very careful, right? Lying is okay, and slandering. But harsh speech, sometimes you may be angry and you may say something bad, right? And then vain talk. So you keep silent most of the time, not talk much. Then you can keep these precepts. Okay, what do you want to ask? So you keep silent most of the time, not talk much. Then you can keep these precepts. Okay, what do you want to ask? Definitely. Yeah, even if the person wants to die, right? If he gives a shot, then he commits the killing. The other person says that desire is one thing and killing is another, right? Killing means making a life shorter than it should have gone normally, right? Suppose a person is going to live, say 80 years. And if somebody makes him live 79 years, something like that, or do something so that his life is shorter, then he commits the killing. So killing is called panatipata in Pali. So panatipata means cutting short the life. Suppose a patient is going to live until midnight today, right? Then the doctor comes and then gives him a shock, and he dies at 11 p.m. So that means he makes his life shorter by 1 hour. And so he commits killing. And in Buddhism, there is no such thing as mercy killing. Because at the moment of killing, it is always accompanied by ill will, by a kind of dosa. You cannot kill anything with pleasure. Sometimes you may be laughing and you may kill an ant, but at the very moment of killing, there is that ill will in your mind, a kind of dosa in your mind, because you want it to be killed. Now you kill it. So you cannot kill with somanasa or something pleasurable feeling, although you may feel pleasure after or before the real act of killing, or after the real act of killing, you may have pleasure. But at the very moment of killing, there is displeasure. So in Buddhism, there is no such thing as mercy killing. That is a question that is difficult to answer. But people say that that person is like a vegetable, right? He does not know or whatever. But according to the definition given in Abhidhamma, he is still a living being. He has not died yet, although his brain may not be functioning, right? Although what called that instrument may show no brain action, right? But even though there may be no brain action, or there is said to be no brain action, there is still consciousness in him. Consciousness as we understood in Abhidhamma. So long as consciousness is there, he is a living being. So cutting short his life, however much suffering there is for him, is killing. So that is why it is very, very difficult. People find with difficult situation when their parents are put on the machine and they have to say, please take it off. So many people ask me, I don't want to give answers to them. Yes, so long as, right? So long as that person is living and you cut short his life, then there is akusala. And actually, a dead person cannot be revived. Dead means clinically dead, right? Clinically dead may not be really dead, because the doctors they don't detect the heartbeat or pulse, and then they say he is dead or something like that. Sometimes people are not really dead, right? So that is why they use clinically dead. That means declared by the doctor to be dead. But sometimes they don't die. So it is very, very difficult to know exactly whether a person is really dead or not. Only after, say, the body becomes cold and then stiff, then you say he is dead. Otherwise, so long as he's on the machine, it's very difficult.
So the doctor also didn't want to check on that he had no pulse, so he was, so the patient made this warrant that he's dead, and they put it in a special bed, and then they called the monks over to the prayer. She wakes up, she doesn't know what's happening, and it's just like,
So he was not dead really.
So that's why he didn't birth him dead.
Okay, you remember the Four Noble Truths now? Can you tell another person about the Four Noble Truths? Ah, very good. You know, it is not easy for Myanmar people to understand the Four Noble Truths like you do now. Yes. Satipatthana is the eighth noble truth, right mindfulness. Yes. That is why when right mindfulness is defined in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, Buddha says the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, later, if you want to ask questions, you can send email to me. I don't answer email much. I left the email with Osada and Uswada Langara. White lies, I would not say okay, but it is not so bad. Now, I told you about running the full course, right? White lie does not run the full course of action, so it may not give very bad results. You break the precept only when your lie causes some injury to others. So you tell a lie to another person, and then it may cause some injury to his life, to his property, something like that. Only when the injury has occurred to him, that the telling lie runs the full course of action. So I think white lie is almost okay. Right? I'm not encouraging you to do this, but sometimes you have a good intention when you say white lie. So you want you do not want to make other person feel angry or feel sorry, or you want to save anger for another person. And so I think it's okay. I think yes. Yeah, because you are causing injury to that, causing suffering to that animal. Or that animal? Oh, if it is dead, it's okay. I thought you're bisecting a live animal. Buddhism teaches that the beginning of being cannot be known. So we do not know when beings first appeared. But for this particular world, there is a beginning. So it is taught in Buddhism that the world comes into being for many years, and then after many years it will be destroyed, and then after many years another world will form by itself, not being created by any being, but it will be formed by itself, and then the beings who are reborn in the Brahma world will die there and then reborn on the human earth, and then begin the population of the world. So in that case, there is a beginning of the world, but the very beginning is not accepted in Buddhism, because if you accept the law of cause and effect, there can be no beginning at all. Somebody must have a cause. Now something must have a cause, right? So if you find this one, then there must be a cause for this one, and there must be a cause of this and this and this, and so you go on to infinity. You will not come to a point where you can say this is the very first, because you have accepted that everything must depend on a cause, and so there is a cause. So long as you accept the law of cause and effect, you cannot find a beginning. Logically, we may say, oh, there must be a beginning. But in actuality, we cannot find a beginning. There are many questions they cannot answer regarding the creation. There are many questions, many problems with that. No. Maybe Buddhist people also believe that the world was a flat. But it is not taught in the books that whether it is flat or round. But it is taught that it is like a circle, right? It's a wheel. And there are mountains all around, and the sea, and the continents, like that.
Nobody said this, but I thought it myself. Because in Christianity, they're waiting for the second coming of Christ.
Yes.
And in Judaism, they think the Messiah will come. And in like the Muslim religion, they believe another prophet will come. And I don't know about Hinduism, but in Buddhism, they believe when the next Buddha comes, the opposite he comes, and the world will finish. Just like that, like this world.
Yes, there's one more Buddha to come.
I think for that time, I think when the Buddha comes, all Buddhism are like become saints. All Buddha is just one more person coming.
I don't know what would happen at that time, right? And it will be many, many years from now. When the future Buddha will come to the world. And it is said that people will live very long at that time, and people will be good at that time. But still, there may be some who don't believe, who don't believe in Buddhism. It's difficult to say, right? What the conditions will be like when the Buddha comes. But hopefully people will be better in their practices when the Buddha comes. Sit on the chair? I don't think so. I mean, it will be as usual, sitting cross-legged. Some too, because you know there is a story of four sons of four rich men who acted badly, and then they fell to hell, and once in a while they come up to the surface, and then they shouted, and they knew what they did in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when
animals go to hell, do they stay in the animal form, or do they become humans? Or do the humans have no form? Like humans. Yeah, hell beings are like you, human beings. But they may also appear in animal form. Okay.